Side 1 of cassette number 4, Glamour, A World Problem. Continuing on page 135.
Let us now consider the intuition, which is the opposite of illusion, remembering that illusion imprisons a man upon the mental plane and surrounds him entirely with man-made thought forms, barring out escape into the higher realms of awareness or into that loving service which must be given in the lower worlds of conscious, manifested effort. The major point I would seek to make here is that the intuition is the source or the bestower of revelation. Through the intuition, progressive understanding of the ways of God in the world and on behalf of humanity are revealed. Through the intuition, the transcendence and the immanence of God is sequentially grasped, and man can enter into that pure knowledge, that inspired reason, which will enable him to comprehend not only the processes of nature in its fivefold divine expression, but also the underlying causes of these processes, proving them effects and not initiatory events. Through the intuition, man arrives at the experience of the kingdom of God and discovers the nature, the type of lives and of phenomena, and the characteristics of the sons of God as they come into manifestation. Through the intuition, some of the plans and purposes working out through the manifested created worlds are brought to his attention, and he is shown in what way he and the rest of humanity can cooperate and hasten the divine purpose. Through the intuition, the laws of the spiritual life, which are the laws governing God himself, conditioning Shambhala and guiding the hierarchy, are brought to his notice progressively, and as he proves capable of appreciating them and working them. Four types of people are subject to revelation through the awakening of the intuition. 1. Those on the line of the world saviors. These touch and sense the divine plan and are pledged to service and to work for the salvation of humanity. They are found expressing different and varying degrees of realization, stretching all the way from the man who seeks to reveal divinity in his own life and to his immediate small circle through the medium of the changes and effects wrought in his personal life, to those great intuitives and world saviors such as the Christ. The former is motivated in all probability by some one intuitive crisis which entirely remade him and gave him a new sense of values. The latter can, at will, rise into the world of intuitive perception and values and there ascertain the will of God and a wide vision of the plan. Such great representatives of deity have the freedom of the holy city, Shambhala, and of the New Jerusalem, the hierarchy. They are thus unique in their contacts, and there have been relatively few of them as yet. 2. Those who are on the line of the prophets. These touch the plan at high intuitive moments and know what the immediate future holds. I do not refer here to the Hebrew prophets so familiar to the West, but to all who see clearly what should be done to lead humanity out of darkness into light, beginning with the situation as it is and looking forward into a future of divine consummation. They have a clear picture in their minds of what is possible to accomplish and the power to point it out to the people of their time. They necessarily range all the way from those who have a relatively clear vision of the cosmic picture and objectives to those who simply see the next step ahead for the race or the nation. Isaiah and Ezekiel are the only two of the Hebrew prophets who had true prophetic and cosmic vision. The others were small but intelligent men who, from analysis and deduction, assessed the immediate future and indicated immediate possibilities. They had no direct revealing intuition. In the New Testament, John, the beloved disciple, was privileged to gain a cosmic picture and a true prophetic vision which he embodied in the Apocalypse. But he is the only one who so achieved, and he achieved because he loved so deeply, so wisely, and so inclusively. His intuition was evoked through the depth and intensity of his love, as it was in his Master, the Christ. 3. Those who are the true priests. They are priests by spiritual calling and not by choice. It is the misunderstanding of the province and duties of a priest which has led all the churches in the East and in the West to their disastrous authoritarian position. The love of God and the true spiritual incentive which recognizes God immanent in all nature and peculiarly expressing that divinity in man is lacking in the bulk of the priesthood in all the world religions. Love is not the guide, the indicator, and the interpreter. Hence the dogmatism of the theologian, his ridiculous and profound assurances of correct interpretation, and his oft-times cruelty cloaked by his claim of right principles and good intentions. But the true priest exists and is found in all religions. He is the friend and the brother of all, and because he loves deeply, wisdom is his, and if he is of a mental type and training, his intuition is awakened and revelation is his reward. Ponder on this. The true priest is rare and is not found only in the so-called holy orders. 4. Those who are the practical mystics or occultists. These, by virtue of a disciplined life, an ardent aspiration, and a trained intellect, have succeeded in evoking the intuition and are therefore personally in touch with the true source of divine wisdom. This it is their function to interpret and to formulate into temporary systems of knowledge. There are many such working patiently today in the world, unrecognized and unsought by the unthinking. Their need today is to assemble themselves in this hour of the world need and so let their voice be clearly heard. These people are resolving the sense of duality into a known unity, and their preoccupation with reality and their deep love of humanity have released the intuition. When this release has taken place, no barriers are felt, and true knowledge as a result of revealed wisdom is the gift which some people have to give to their race and time. These are the four groups who are exchanging illusion for the intuition. This is the initial resolution of the pairs of opposites, for there is no such resolution without the aid of the intellect, because the intellect, through analysis, discrimination, and right reasoning, indicates what should be done. B. The contrast between glamour and illumination. One of the aptest symbols by which one can gather some picture of the nature of glamour is to picture the astral plane on three of its levels, the second, third, and fourth, counting from the top downwards, as a land shrouded in a thick fog of varying densities. The ordinary light of the ordinary man, which is similar to the headlights of a car and their self-sufficient blaze, serves only to intensify the problem and fails to penetrate into the mists and the fog. It simply throws it into relief so that its density and its deterring effects become the more apparent. The condition of fog is revealed, but that is all. So it is on the astral plane in relation to glamour. The light which is in man, self-induced and self-generated, fails ever to penetrate into or to dissipate the gloom and the foggy, miasmic conditions. The only light which can dissipate the fogs of glamour and rid the life of its ill effects is that of the soul, which, like a pure dispelling beam, possesses the curious and unique quality of revelation, of immediate dissipation, and of illumination. The revelation vouchsafed is different to that of the intuition, for it is the revelation of that which the glamour veils and hides, which is a revelation unique to the astral plane and conditioned by its laws. This particular utilization of soul light takes the form of a focused concentration of the light emanating from the soul via the mind upon the state of glamour, particular or specific or general and worldwide, so that the nature of the glamour is revealed, its quality and basis is discovered, and its power is brought to an end by a steady prolonged period of concentration which is given to the dispelling of the condition. In our next section, we will deal in detail with the technique of this scientific use of light, and therefore I will not elaborate the theme at this point. I will only deal with that much of it as will enable you as a group to begin your long-awaited work upon the problem of dispelling the present world glamour, at least in some of its aspects. I am not defining glamour in this place or giving you instances of its activity, as I did in the case of illusion and its contrasting correspondence, the intuition, because I covered the ground very thoroughly in the section immediately preceding, and you have only to refer to that section to read all that I am prepared to give you at this time. I will, however, briefly define illumination, asking you to bear in mind that we are not here dealing with the illumination which reveals reality, or the nature of the soul, or which makes clear to your vision the kingdom of the soul, but with that form of illumination which is thrown down by the soul into the world of the astral plane. This involves the conscious use of light and its employment, first of all, as a searchlight, scanning the astral horizon and localizing the glamour which is causing the trouble, and secondly, as a focused distribution of light, turned with intention upon that area of the astral plane wherein it is proposed that some effort be made to dissipate the fog and mist which are there concentrated. Certain basic premises are therefore in order, and these might be stated as follows. 1. The quality and the major characteristic of the soul is light. Therefore, if that light is to be used, and that quality expressed by the disciple and the worker, he must first of all achieve a recognized contact with the soul through meditation. 2. The quality of the astral plane, its major characteristic, is glamour. It is the field whereon the great battle of the pairs of opposites must be fought, as they are the expression of ancient desire, in the one case glamorous, deceptive, and false, and in the other, high spiritual longing for that which is real and true. It should be here remembered that astral desire, wrong and selfish emotion, and astral reactions to the facts of daily life are not natural to the soul and constitute eventually a condition which serves to veil successfully the true nature of the spiritual man. 3. A relation must then be established between the soul and the astral plane via the astral body of the disciple. This astral body must be regarded by him as his response apparatus to the world of sensation, and as the only instrument whereby his soul can contact that level of expression, temporary and non-lasting as it may be. The disciple must therefore establish contact with the soul and do this consciously and with the needed emphasis, and so carry soul light to his own astral body, learn to focus it there in the solar plexus center, and from that point of achievement proceed to work upon the astral plane at the arduous task of dispelling glamour. 4. When this line of contact has been made and the soul, the astral body, and the astral plane have thus been intimately related, the disciple must carry the focused light from the solar plexus, where it has been temporarily localized, to the heart center. There he must steadily hold it and work consistently and perseveringly from that higher center. I might here paraphrase an ancient instruction for disciples which can be found in the archives of the hierarchy and which refers to this particular process. I am giving you a brief and somewhat inadequate paraphrase of this ancient symbolic wording. Quote, the disciple stands and, with his back to the glamorous fog, looks towards the east from whence the light must stream. Within his heart he gathers all the light available, and from that point of power between the shoulder blades, the light streams forth. Close quote. 5. The disciple must relinquish all sense of tension or of strain and must learn to work with pure faith and love. The less he feels and the less he is preoccupied with his own feelings or sense of achievement or of non-achievement, the more probable it will be that the work will proceed with effectiveness and the glamour be slowly dispelled. In this work there is no haste. That which is very ancient cannot be immediately dispelled, no matter how good the intention or how accurate may be the grasp of the needed technique. It will be apparent to you that there are elements of danger in this work. Unless the members of the group are exceedingly watchful, and unless they cultivate the habit of careful observation, they may suffer from overstimulation of the solar plexus, until such time as they have mastered the process of rapidly transferring the light of the soul, focused in the solar plexus, and the innate light of the astral body, also found localized in that center, into the heart center between the shoulder blades. I would therefore warn each and all of you to proceed with the utmost care, and I would caution you that if you suffer any solar plexus disturbance or encounter in yourselves any increased emotional instability, to be not unduly disturbed. I would ask you to regard the phenomenon of disturbance as simply a temporary difficulty, incident upon the service which you are seeking to render. If you pay this intelligent attention to the matter and no more, refusing to be distressed or to be disturbed, no bad results will be felt. In connection with your anticipated group work along these lines, you will proceed with your group meditation as indicated elsewhere. Discipleship in a New Age, Volume 1, page 61. And then, when you have arrived at stage 3 in the group meditation, you will work together as follows. 1. Having linked up with all your group brothers, then consciously carry out the hints given symbolically in the ancient writing, which I paraphrase for you above. A. Link up consciously with your soul and realize this linking as a fact. B. Then carry the light of the soul through the power of the creative imagination direct to your astral body and from thence to the solar plexus center, which is the line of least resistance. C. Then transfer the light of the soul and the innate light of the astral body from the solar plexus center to the heart center by a definite act of the will. 2. Then, imaginatively, stand with your back to the world of glamour and with the eye of your mind focused on the soul whose nature is love. 3. Let a few minutes interlude then take place wherein you stabilize yourself for the work and definitely and consciously focus the light available from all sources within the heart center. Imagine that center between the shoulder blades as a radiant sun. I might here point out that this is, in the individual, the microcosmic correspondence to the heart of the sun, which is always directed by the central spiritual sun, localized in the head. Get this picture clearly into your consciousness, for it involves the dual yet synthetic activity of the head and the heart. 4. Then see a shaft of pure white light, broad and brilliant, pouring out of the heart center between the shoulder blades onto that localized glamour with which you as a group are dealing. What this localized area is, I will presently disclose. 5. When this is clearly defined in your mind and inspired by your desire and force, and when you have the entire symbolic picture clearly visualized, then see your particular shaft of light blended with the shafts of light which your group brothers are projecting. Thus a great flood of directed light coming from several trained aspirants, and are you trained, my brothers, will pour on to that area of glamour with which you are supposed to deal. 6. Do this work for 5 carefully sustained minutes, and then proceed as indicated in stage 4 of your meditation outline. In defining illumination as the antithesis of glamour, it is obvious that my remarks must necessarily be limited to certain aspects of illumination and will only concern those directed forms of work and those presentations of the problem which will concern the use of light upon the astral plane and particularly in connection with the work that you have pledged yourselves to do. There are many other definitions possible, for the light of the soul is like an immense searchlight, the beams of which can be turned in many directions and focused on many levels. We are, however, only concerned here with its specialized use. Illumination and the light of knowledge can be regarded as synonymous terms, and many glamours can be dissipated and dispersed when subjected to the potency of the informative mind, for the mind is essentially the subduer of emotion through the presentation of fact. The problem is to induce the individual, or the race, or nation, which is acting under the influence of glamour, to call in the mental power of assessing the situation and subject it to a calm, cold scrutiny. Glamour and emotion play into each other's hands, and feeling runs so strong, usually in relation to glamour, that it is impossible to bring in the light of knowledge with ease and effectiveness. Illumination and perception of truth are also synonymous terms, but it should be remembered that the truth in this case is not the truth on the abstract plane, but concrete and knowable truth, truth which can be formulated and expressed in concrete form and terms. Where the light of truth is called in, glamour automatically disappears, even if only for a temporary period. But again, difficulty arises because few people care to face the actual truth, for it involves eventually the abandonment of the beloved glamour and the ability to recognize error and to admit mistakes, and this the false pride of the mind will not permit. Again, I would assure you that humility is one of the most potent factors in releasing the illuminating power of the mind as it reflects and transmits the light of the soul. The determined facing of the factual life and the stern recognition of truth coldly, calmly, and dispassionately, will greatly facilitate the calling in of the flood of illumination which will suffice to dispel glamour. As we are dealing with the problem of glamour and illumination, it might be of value here if I dealt with the particular glamour which I would ask your group to aid in dispelling. I refer here to the glamour of separateness. Work along this line will have most practical and salutary implications, for none of you, as you will discover, will be able to work effectively on this matter if you feel any sense of separativeness. This separative reaction may express itself as hatred, as an active dislike, or as a voiced criticism, perhaps in some cases all three. There are forces which you may personally regard as separativeness or as the cause of separation. I would remind you that the favorite views and cherished beliefs of those to whom you are mentally opposed, often under the guise of a strenuous adherence to what you regard as right principles, are to those who hold them equally right. They feel that your views are erroneous and they regard them as separative in their effect and as the basis of trouble. They are, in their place, as sincere as you are and as eager for the achievement of the right attitude as you feel yourself to be. This is something often forgotten, and I would remind you of it. I might also illustrate this point by pointing out to you that the hatreds or the dislike, if hatred is too strong a word, that any of you may feel for the activities of the German government and for the line that they have taken against the Jewish people might be turned with almost equal justification against the Jews themselves. The latter have always been separative and have regarded themselves as the chosen of the Lord, and have never proved assimilable in any nation. The same can be said of the Germans, and from many they evoke the same reaction as they mete out to the Jew, though not the physical persecution. Neither attitude, as you well know, is justifiable from the angle of the soul. They are both equally wrong, and this is a point of view which the Jew and the anti-Jew must eventually understand, and through understanding, bring to an end. I mention this because I am going to ask you to deal with that ancient and worldwide glamour, the glamour of the hatred of the Jew. In this group, there are those who are, in their thought at least, violently anti-German. There are others who are definitely, though intelligently, anti-Jew. I would ask those in both these groups to recognize the problem with which they are faced. It is a problem which is so very ancient and deeply rooted in the consciousness of the race that it is far bigger than the individual can possibly vision. The individual point of view is consequently so limited that constructive usefulness is noticeably impaired. After all, my brothers, the point of view of the underdog is not necessarily the only one or necessarily always the correct one. Both the Germans and the Jews merit our impersonal love, particularly as they are both guilty, if I may use such a term, of the same basic errors and faults. The German is powerfully race-conscious, so is the Jew. The German is separative in his attitude to the world, so is the Jew. The German insists today on racial purity, a thing upon which the Jew has insisted for centuries. A small group of Germans are anti-Christian, so are an equally small number of Jews. I could continue piling up these resemblances, but the above will suffice. Therefore, your dislike of one group is not more warranted than your refusal to recognize any justification for the activities and attitudes of the other. Like frequently repudiates and swings away from like, and the Germans and the Jews are curiously alike. Just as many British people and the preponderance of the British race are reincarnated Romans, so many Germans are reincarnated Jews. Hence the similarity of their points of view. It is a family quarrel, and there is nothing more terrible than this. I'm going to ask you to take the Germans and the Jews into your group meditation and pour out your group love upon both these divisions of your brothers in the human family. See to it that before you begin your meditation, you have freed yourselves, emotions and mind, from any latent antagonisms, from any hatreds, from any preconceived ideas of right or wrong, but that you simply fall back upon the love of your souls, remembering that both Jews and Germans are souls as you are, and identical in their origin, their goal, and their life experience with yours. As you pour out the stream of pure white light, as stage 3 instructs you, see to it that it pours through you with purity and clarity as one stream. Then see it bisect into equal quantities or proportions, one stream of living light and love going to the Jews and the other to the German people. The quality of your love will count, and not so much the accuracy of your analysis or the perfection of your technique. C. The contrast between Maya and inspiration. Here we come definitely into the realm of material substance. This is essentially, and in a peculiar manner, the realm of force. Maya is predominantly, for the individual, the aggregate of the forces which control his septenary force centers, to the exclusion, I would emphasize, of the controlling energy of the soul. Therefore, you will see that the bulk of humanity, until a man stands upon the probationary path, are under the control of Maya, for a man succumbs to Maya when he is controlled by any other force or forces than those energies which come direct from the soul, conditioning and controlling the lesser forces of the personality as they eventually and inevitably must and will. When a man is under the control of physical, astral, and mental forces, he is convinced at the time that they are for him right forces. Herein lies the problem of Maya. Such forces, however, when they control a man, determine him in a separative attitude and produce an effect which feeds and stimulates the personality and does not bring in the energy of the soul, the true individuality. This analysis should prove illuminating to you. If men and women would bring their lives under a closer scrutiny by the true inner or spiritual man, and could thus determine what combination of energies conditions their life activity, they would not continue to function as they do now, so blindly, so inadequately, and so ineffectually. It is for this reason that the study and understanding of motives is of such value and importance, for such a study determines intellectually, if properly investigated, what factor or factors inspires the daily life. This is a statement worth careful consideration. I would ask you, what is your major actuating motive? For whatever it may be, it conditions and determines your predominant life tendencies. Many people, particularly the unintelligent masses, are solely inspired by desire, material, physical, and temporary. Animal desire for the satisfaction of the animal appetites, material desire for possession and for the luxuries of existence, the longing for things, for comforts and for security, economic, social, and religious, control the majority. The man is under the influence of the densest form of Maya, and the forces of his nature are concentrated in the sacral center. Others are motivated by some form of aspiration or ambition, aspiration towards some material heaven, and most religions portray heaven in this manner, ambitions for power, desire for the satisfaction of the emotional or aesthetic appetites, and for the possession of the more subtle realities, and the longing for emotional comfort, for mental stability, and assurance that the higher desires will meet with gratification. All this is Maya in its emotional form, and it is not the same thing as glamour. In the case of glamour, the forces of a man's nature are seated in the solar plexus. In the case of Maya, they are seated in the sacral center. Glamour is subtle and emotional. Maya is tangible and etheric. Such are the forces of Maya which actuate, motivate, and energize the life of the ordinary man. Under their influence, he is helpless, for they inspire all his thinking, all his aspiration and his desire, and all his activity on the physical plane. His problem is twofold. One, to bring all his centers under the inspiration of the soul. Two, to transfer or transmute the forces of the lower centers, which control the personality, into the energies of the centers above the diaphragm, which respond automatically to the inspiration of the soul. It is in this thought that the potency and the symbolic value of breathing exercises consist. The motive is soul control, and though the methods employed are, in many cases, definitely undesirable, yet the developing tendency of the life thought will prove inevitably determining and conditioning. The methods used may not save the unprepared physical body from certain evil and disastrous results, yet in the long run and in the last analysis, they may condition the future experience, probably in another life, in such a manner that the aspirant will find himself more able to function as a soul than might otherwise have been the case. Before I close this particular instruction upon glamour, I would like to call the attention of the group to the occult sentences which I gave to D.L.R. prior to his leaving the group. They have a definite relation to the group work, and I would like you to give them careful consideration and study. The old commentary, in speaking of the work of those whose dharma it is to dissipate world glamour, uses the following illuminating sentences. Quote, they come and stand within the midst of whirling forms, some of beauty rare and some of horror and despair, they stand. They look not here or there, but with their faces turned towards the light, they stand. Thus through their minds the pure light streams to dissipate the fog. They come and rest. They cease their outer labors, pausing to do a different work. Within their hearts is rest. They run not here and there, but constitute a point of peace and rest. That which upon the surface veils and hides the real begins to disappear, and from the heart at rest a beam of dissipating force projects, blends with the shining light, and then the mists of man's creation disappear. They come and they observe. They own the eye of vision. Likewise, they own the right direction of the needed force. They see the glamour of the world, and seeing, they note behind it all the true, the beautiful, the real. Thus, through the eye of Buddhi comes the power to drive away the veiling, swirling glamours of that glamorous world. They stand, they rest, and they observe. Such are their lives, and such the service that they render to the souls of men. I would commend these lines to your careful thought. They convey to you not only the field of your group service, but also the desired attitude of the personal life of every member of the group. I would also like, at this point, to touch upon a factor of real importance in this work and to repeat my earlier warning. Will you remember that the effort to free yourselves from irritation, or from what is called in Anyi Yoga, imperil, a peculiar yet satisfying word, my brothers, is particularly essential for this group. Irritation is exceedingly prevalent these days of nervous tension, and it most definitely imperils progress and retards the steps of the disciple upon the way. It can produce dangerous group tension if present in any of you, and this induced group tension can interfere with the free play of the power and light which you are supposed to use, even when the other group members remain unconscious of the emanating source. Irritation definitely generates a poison which locates itself in the region of the stomach and of the solar plexus. Irritation is a disease, if I might use that word, of the solar plexus center, and it is definitely contagious to an almost alarming extent. So, my brothers, watch yourselves with care, and remember that just insofar as you can live in the head and in the heart, you will end the disease of imperil, and aid in the transference of the forces of the solar plexus into the heart center. D. The contrast between the dweller and its opposite, the angel of the presence. The entire subject of the dweller and its relation to the angel, a symbolic way of dealing with a great relationship and possibility and a great fact in manifestation, is only now possible of consideration. Only when man is an integrated personality does the problem of the dweller truly arise, and only when the mind is alert and the intelligence organized, as is becoming the case today on a fairly large scale, is it possible for man to sense intelligently and not just mystically the angel and so intuit the presence. Only then does the entire question of hindrances which the dweller embodies and the limitations which it provides to spiritual contact and realization assume potent proportions. Only then can they be usefully considered and steps taken to induce right action. Only when there is adequate fusion within humanity as a whole does the great human dweller on the threshold appear as an integrated entity, or the dweller, in a national or racial sense, makes its appearance, spreading and vitalizing national, racial, and planetary glamour, fostering and feeding individual glamours, and making the entire problem unmistakably apparent. Only then can the relation between the soul of humanity and the generated forces of its ancient and potent personality assume proportions which call for drastic activity and intelligent cooperation. Such a time has now come, and in the two books, The Problems of Humanity and The Reappearance of the Christ, and also in the Waysack and June Full Moon Messages, I have dealt with this most practical and urgent situation, which is in itself the guarantee of human progress toward its destined goal, as well as the assertion of its major hindrances to spiritual realization. The sections on which we shall now be engaged are of prime importance to all who are in training for initiation. I said, in training, my brothers. I did not say that you would take initiation in this life. I know not myself whether you will or no. The issue lies in your hands and in your planned destiny, planned by your souls. Your problem is essentially that of learning to handle the dweller on the threshold and of ascertaining the procedures and the processes whereby the momentous activity of fusion can take place. Through the medium of this fusion, the dweller, quote, disappears and is no more seen, though still he functions on the outer plane, the agent of the angel. The light absorbs the dweller, and into obscuration, radiant yet magnetic, this ancient form of life dissolves, though keeping still its form. It rests and works, but is not now itself. Close quote. Such are the paradoxical statements of the old commentary. I have earlier defined for you, in as simple terms as possible, the nature of the dweller. I would like, however, to enlarge upon one or two points and give one or two new suggestions, which, for the sake of clarity and for your more rapid comprehension, we will tabulate as follows. 1. The dweller on the threshold is essentially the personality. It is an integrated unity composed of physical forces, vital energy, astral forces, and mental energy, constituting the sum total of the lower nature. 2. The dweller takes form when a reorientation of man's life has taken place consciously and under soul impression. The whole personality is then theoretically directed towards liberation into service. The problem is to make the theory and the aspirations facts in experience. 3. For a great length of time, the forces of the personality do not constitute a dweller. The man is not on the threshold of divinity. He is not consciously aware of the angel. His forces are inchoate. He works unconsciously in his environment, the victim of circumstance and of his own nature, apparently, and under the lure and the urge of desire for physical plane activity and existence. When, however, the life of the man is ruled from the mental plane plus desire or ambition, and he is controlled at least to some large extent by mental influence, then the dweller begins to take shape as a unified force. 4. The stages wherein the dweller on the threshold is recognized, subjected to a discriminating discipline, and finally controlled and mastered are mainly 3. A. The stage wherein the personality dominates and rules the life and ambitions and the goals of man's life endeavor. The dweller then controls. B. The stage of a growing cleavage in the consciousness of the disciple. The dweller or the personality is then urged in two directions. One, towards the pursuit of personal ambitions and desires in the three worlds. The other, in which the effort is made by the dweller, note this statement, to take a stand upon the threshold of divinity and before the portal of initiation. C. The stage wherein the dweller consciously seeks the cooperation of the soul and, though still in itself essentially constituting a barrier to spiritual progress, is more and more influenced by the soul than by its lower nature. 5. When the final stage is reached, and many are now reaching it today, the disciple strives with more or less success to steady the dweller by learning to hold the mind steady in the light and thus controlling the lower nature. In this way, the constant fluid changefulness of the dweller is gradually overcome. Its orientation towards reality and away from the great illusion is made effective, and the angel and the dweller are slowly brought into a close rapport. 6. In the earlier stages of effort and of attempted control, the dweller is positive and the soul is negative in their effects in the three worlds of human endeavor. Then there is a period of oscillation, leading to a life of equilibrium, wherein neither aspect appears to dominate. After that, the balance changes and the personality steadily becomes negative, and the soul or psyche becomes dominant and positive. 7. The astrological influences can potently affect these situations, and, speaking generally and within certain esoteric limits, it might be noted that A. Leo controls the positive dweller, B. Gemini controls the processes of oscillation, C. Sagittarius controls the negative dweller. It might be added that the three signs, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, lead finally to the fusion of the dweller and the angel. 8. The soul ray controls and conditions the activity of the angel and its type of influence upon the dweller. It affects karma, times, and seasons. 9. The personality ray controls the dweller in all the earlier states and up to the time when the soul ray begins steadily to produce a growing effect. This personality ray is, as you know, a combination of three energies which produce the fourth, or personality ray, through the medium of their interrelation over a vast period of time. 10. Therefore, the five types of energy which I indicated to you as of importance in your own lives, when I gave you indications as to the nature of your five controlling rays, govern also the relation between the dweller and the angel, both in the individual and in humanity as a whole. These five are the rays of the physical body, the astral ray, the mind ray, the personality ray, and the soul ray. 11. The rays which govern humanity and which condition humanity and the present world problem are as follows. A. The soul ray. Second, humanity must express love. B. The personality ray. Third, developing intelligence for transmutation into love wisdom. C. Mind ray. Fifth, scientific achievement. D. Astral ray. Sixth, idealistic development. E. Physical ray. Seventh, organization, business. The soul ray controls for an entire life period. The personality rays, given above, are for the Piscean age, which is now beginning to pass out. But these have definitely and irrevocably conditioned humanity. You will note also that the first ray of will or power is missing, as is the fourth ray of harmony through conflict. This fourth ray is always active as it controls in a peculiar manner the fourth creative hierarchy and might be regarded as forming the basic personality ray of the fourth creative hierarchy. The one given above is a transient and fleeting personality ray of a minor incarnation. 12. In the Aquarian age, which is rapidly coming, the dweller will present slightly different personality forces. A. Personality ray, fifth, basic and determining. B. Mind ray, fourth, the creative effect. C. Astral ray, sixth, conditioning incentive. D. Physical ray, seventh, incoming ray. 13. Each great cycle in the zodiac is in the nature of an incarnation of the human family, and each great race is a somewhat similar happening. The latter is, however, of more importance where the human understanding and consciousness is concerned. The analogy is to the few important incarnations in the life of the soul, in contradistinction to the many unimportant and rapidly succeeding incarnations. Of the important incarnations, there are three which are of major import: the Lemurian, the Atlantean, and the Aryan races. 14. Each race produced its own type of dweller on the threshold, who was faced at the close of the spiritual cycle, not the physical, which goes on to crystallization, when maturity was achieved and a certain initiation became possible for its advanced humanity. 15. When a racial incarnation and a zodiacal cycle synchronize, which is not always the case, then there comes a significant and important focusing of the attention of the dweller on the angel and vice versa. This is taking place at this time at the close of the Piscean era, and when the Aryan race has reached maturity and a relatively high watermark of development. Discipleship is significant of maturity, and it is with mature development that the dweller is met. The Aryan race is ready for discipleship. 16. The development of sensitivity in the individual and in the race indicates the imminence of the recognition of the angel from both angles of vision and the immediacy of the opportunity. This opportunity for active fusion has never been so true as now. 17. The lines of demarcation as existing between the recognized areas of influence between the dweller and the angel are clearer than ever before in the history of the race. Man knows the difference between right and wrong and must now choose the way that he shall go. In the Atlantean racial crisis, which was also a complete human crisis, the history of which is perpetuated for us in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, symbol of the then disciple and the world disciple, was frankly bewildered. This is not so true now. The disciples of the world and the world disciple do see the issues today relatively quite clearly. Will expediency win, or will the dweller be sacrificed with love and understanding to the angel? This is the major problem.
End of side one, Glamour, a World Problem, page 158. Side 2, cassette number 4, Glamour, A World Problem, continuing on page 159.
I will ask you, my brother, to do two things. Study the above ideas in the light of the present world crisis and in the light of your own soul personality problem. Advanced humanity stands as the dweller on the very threshold of divinity. The angel stands expectant, absorbed in the presence, yet ready to absorb the dweller. Humanity has advanced in consciousness to the very boundaries of the world of spiritual values and the kingdom of light and of God. The angel has come to earth in expectation of recognition, an event of which the advent of Christ 2,000 years ago was the symbol and the precursor. This is the situation where all advanced aspirants are concerned. It can be yours. It is the situation also where humanity as a whole is concerned and the approaching hierarchy. The consciousness of humanity from the higher and spiritual standpoint functions today through the steadily growing band of world servers, world aspirants, and world disciples, and their name is Legion. Humanity today is the dweller, whilst the hierarchy of souls is the angel, and behind stands the presence of divinity itself, intuited by the hierarchy and dimly sensed by humanity, but providing in this manner that threefold synthesis which is divine manifestation in form. All these three have powerful emanations, though the emanations of the presence, via Shambhala, have been wisely held in leash since the human race came into being. They all have auras, if you care so to call them, and in the three worlds at present, that of the dweller is still the most powerful. Just as in the life of the aspirant, his personality is as yet the dominant predisposing factor. It is this powerful human emanation which constitutes the major glamour in the life of humanity and of the individual disciple. It is a synthesis of glamour fused and blended by the personality ray, but precipitated by the effect of the steadily influencing soul ray. It is the shadow or distortion of reality, now sensed for the first time on a large scale by the race of men and thrown into high relief by the light which shines from the angel, the transmitter of energy from the presence. And so they stand, humanity and the hierarchy, and so you stand, my brother, personality and soul, with freedom to go forward into the light if you so determine, or to remain static and unprogressive, learning nothing and getting nowhere. You are equally free to return to identification with the dweller, negating thus the influence of the angel, refusing imminent opportunity, and postponing until a much later cycle your determining choice. This is true of you and of humanity as a whole. Will humanity's third ray materialistic personality dominate the present situation, or will its soul of love prove the most powerful factor, taking hold of the personality and its little issues, leading it to discriminate rightly and to recognize the true values and thus bring in the age of soul or hierarchical control? Time alone will show. I will give you no more today. I am anxious for these few essential statements to be mastered by all of you prior to our taking up section 3. I am anxious, too, for the general group instructions which you have lately received to take much of your time, interest, and attention. Inner group adjustments and more firmly established group relations are urgently needed, and upon these I ask you to work. I would remind you here also that, as in all else in manifestation, there is a group personality and a group soul. You must learn clearly to distinguish between the two and to throw the entire weight of your influence, desire, and pressure on the side of the group angel. In this way, there might occur that stupendous recognition for which all initiation prepares the applicant, the revelation of the presence. Section 3, the ending of glamour. We come now to the consideration of the third section relating to world glamour. It is difficult to write clearly about this matter because we are in the midst of its most concentrated expression, the worst the world has ever seen, because glamour, incident to centuries of greed and selfishness, of aggression and materialism, has been focused in a triplicity of nations. It is therefore easily to be seen and most effective in manifestation. Three nations express the three aspects of world glamour, illusion, glamour, and Maya, in an amazing manner, and their powerful assault upon the consciousness of humanity is dependent not only upon the response of Germany, Japan, and Italy to this ancient miasma, but also upon the fact that every nation, United Nations as well as totalitarian nations, are tainted with this universal condition. The freedom of the world is consequently largely dependent upon those people in every nation who, within themselves, have moved forward out of one or other of these glamorous illusions and Mayavic impressions of the human soul into a state of awareness wherein they can see the conflict in its wider terms, i.e., as that existing for them between the dweller on the threshold and the angel of the presence. These people are the aspirants, disciples, and initiates of the world. They are aware of the dualism, the essential dualism, of the conflict, and are not so preeminently conscious of the threefold nature and the differentiated condition of the situation which underlies the realized dualism. Their approach to the problem is therefore simpler, and because of this, world direction lies largely in their hands at this time. It is right here that religion has, as a whole, gone astray. I refer to Orthodox religion. It has been preoccupied with the dweller on the threshold, and the eyes of the theologian have been held upon the material phenomenal aspect of life through fear and its immediacy, and the fact of the angel has been a theory and a point of wishful thinking. The balance is being adjusted by the humanitarian attitudes which are so largely coming into control, irrespective of any theological trend. These attitudes take their stand upon the belief of the innate rightness of the human spirit, in the divinity of man, and upon the indestructible nature of the soul of mankind. This inevitably brings in the concept of the presence, or of God immanent, and is the result of the needed revolt against the belief in God transcendent. This spiritual revelation was entirely a balancing process and need cause no basic concern. For God transcendent eternally exists, but can only be seen and known and correctly approached by God immanent, immanent in individual man, in groups and nations, in organized forms and in religion, in humanity as a whole, and in the planetary life itself. Humanity is today, and has been for ages, battling illusion, glamour, and Maya. Advanced thinkers, those upon the probationary path, upon the path of discipleship, and the path of initiation, have reached a point where materialism and spirituality, the dweller on the threshold and the angel of the presence, and the basic dualism of manifestation can be seen clearly defined. Because of this clarity of demarcation, the issues underlying the present world events, the objectives of the present worldwide struggle, the modes and methods of re-establishing the spiritual contact so prevalent in Atlantean days and so long lost, and the recognition of the techniques which can bring in the new world era and its cultural order can be clearly noted and appraised. All generalizations admit of error. It might, however, be said that Germany has focused in herself world glamour, the most potent and expressive of the three aspects of glamour. Japan is manifesting the force of Maya, the crudest form of material force. Italy, individualistic and mentally polarized, is the expression of world illusion. The United Nations, with all their faults, limitations, weaknesses, and nationalisms, are focusing the conflict between the dweller and the angel, and thus the three forms of glamour and the final form of the conflict between the spiritual ideal and its material opponent are appearing simultaneously. The United Nations are, however, gradually and most decisively throwing the weight of their effort and aspiration onto the side of the angel, thus restoring the lost balance and slowly producing on a planetary scale those attributes and conditions which will eventually dispel illusion, dissipate glamour, and devitalize the prevalent Maya. This they are doing by the increased clear thinking of the general public of all the nations, bound together to conquer the three axis powers by their growing ability to conceive ideas in terms of the whole, in terms of a desirable world order or federation, and their capacity to discriminate between the forces of light and the potency of evil or materialism. The work being done by those who see the world stage as the arena for the conflict between the dweller on the threshold and the angel of the presence might be itemized as 1. The producing of those world conditions in which the forces of light can overcome the forces of evil. This they do by the weight of their armed forces plus their clear insight. 2. The educating of humanity in the distinction between A. spirituality and materialism, pointing to the differing goals of the combatant forces. B. sharing and greed, outlining a future world wherein the four freedoms will be dominant and all will have that which is needed for right living processes. C. light and dark, demonstrating the difference between an illumined future of liberty and opportunity and the dark future of slavery. D. fellowship and separation, indicating a world order where racial hatreds, caste distinctions, and religious differences will form no barrier to international understanding, and the axis order of master races, determined religious attitudes, and enslaved peoples. E. the whole and the part, pointing to the time which is approaching under the evolutionary urge of spirit, wherein the part or the point of life assumes its responsibility for the whole, and the whole exists for the good of the part. The dark aspect has been brought about by ages of glamour. The light is being emphasized and made clear by the world aspirants and disciples, who, by their attitudes, their actions, their writings, and their utterances, are bringing the light into dark places. 3. Preparing the way for the three spiritual energies which will sweep humanity into an era of comprehension, leading to a focused mental clarification of men's minds throughout the world. These three imminent energies are A. the energy of the intuition, which will gradually dispel world illusion and produce automatically a great augmentation of the ranks of the initiates. B. the activity of light, which will dissipate by the energy of illumination the world glamour and bring many thousands onto the path of discipleship. C. the energy of inspiration, which will bring about through the medium of its sweeping potency the devitalization or the removal, as by a wind, of the attractive power of Maya or substance. This will release untold thousands onto the path of probation. 4. Releasing new life into the planet through the medium of every possible agency. The first step towards this release is the proving that the power of materialism is broken by the complete defeat of the Axis powers, and secondly, by the ability of the United Nations to demonstrate, when this has been done, the potency of the spiritual values by their constructive undertakings to restore world order and to lay those foundations which will guarantee a better and more spiritual way of life. These constructive attitudes and undertakings must be assumed individually by every person and by nations as collective wholes. The first is being undertaken at this time. The second remains as yet to be done. 5. Bringing home to the nations of the world the truths taught by the Buddha, the Lord of Light, and the Christ, the Lord of Love. In this connection, it might be pointed out that basically, A. the Axis nations need to grasp the teaching of the Buddha as he enunciated it in the Four Noble Truths. They need to realize that the cause of all sorrow and woe is desire for that which is material. B. the United Nations need to learn to apply the law of love as enunciated in the life of Christ, and to express the truth that no man liveth unto himself, and no nation either, and that the goal of all human effort is loving understanding, prompted by a program of love for the whole. If the lives and teachings of these two great avatars can be comprehended and wrought out anew in the lives of men today, in the world of human affairs, in the realm of human thinking, and in the arena of daily living, the present world order, which is today largely disorder, can be so modified and changed that a new world and a new race of men can gradually come into being. Renunciation and the use of the sacrificial will should be the keynote for the interim period after the war, prior to the inauguration of the new age. Students need to remember that all manifestations and every point of crisis are symbolized by the ancient symbol of a point within the circle, the focus of power within a sphere of influence or aura. So it is today with the entire problem of ending the world glamour and illusion which fundamentally lie behind the present acute situation and world catastrophe. The possibility of such a dispelling and dissipation is definitely centered in the two avatars, the Buddha and the Christ. Within the world of glamour, the world of the astral plane and of the emotions, appeared a point of light. The Lord of Light, the Buddha, undertook to focus in himself the illumination which would eventually make possible the dissipation of glamour. Within the world of illusion, the world of the mental plane, appeared the Christ, the Lord of Love himself, who embodied in himself the power of the attractive will of God. He undertook to dispel illusion by drawing to himself, by the potency of love, the hearts of all men, and stated this determination in the words, "I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me." From the 12th chapter of John, verse 32. From the point they then will have reached, the world of spiritual perception, of truth, and of divine ideas will stand revealed. The result will be the disappearing of illusion. The combined work of these two great sons of God, concentrated through the world disciples and through their initiates, must and will inevitably shatter illusion and dispel glamour, the one by the intuitive recognition of reality by minds attuned to it, and the other by the pouring in of the light of reason. The Buddha made the first planetary effort to dissipate world glamour. The Christ made the first planetary effort towards the dispelling of illusion. Their work must now be intelligently carried forward by a humanity wise enough to recognize its dharma. Men are being rapidly disillusioned and will consequently see more clearly. The world glamour is being steadily removed from the ways of men. These two developments have been brought about by the incoming new ideas focused through the world intuitives and released to the general public by the world thinkers. It has been also largely aided by the well-nigh unconscious, but nonetheless real, recognition of the true meaning of these four noble truths by the masses. Disillusioned and deglamored, if I may use such a term, humanity awaits the coming revelation. This revelation will be brought about by the combined efforts of the Buddha and the Christ. All that we can foresee or foretell anent that revelation is that some potent and far-reaching results will be achieved by the merging of light and love, and by the reaction of lighted substance to the attractive power of love. In this sentence, I have given those who can understand a profound and useful hint as to the method and purpose of the undertaking which was staged for the June full moon, 1942. I have also given a clue to the true understanding of the work of these avatars, a thing hitherto quite unrealized. It might be added that when an appreciation of the meaning of the words transfiguration of a human being is gained, the realization will come that when the body is full of light, then in that light shall we see light. This means that when the personality has reached a point of purification, of dedication, and of illumination, then the attractive power of the soul, whose nature is love and understanding, can function, and fusion of these two will take place. This is what the Christ proved and demonstrated. When the work of the Buddha, or the embodied Buddhic principle, is consummated in the aspiring disciple and in his integrated personality, then the full expression of the work of the Christ, the embodied principle of love, can also be consummated, and both these potencies, light and love, will find radiant expression in the transfigured disciple. What is true, therefore, of the individual is true also of humanity as a whole. And today humanity, having reached maturity, can enter into realization and consciously take part in the work of enlightenment and of spiritual loving activity. The practical effects of this process will be the dissipation of glamour and the release of the human spirit from the thraldom of matter. It will produce also the dispelling of illusion and the recognition of truth as it exists in the consciousness of those who are polarized in the awareness of the Christ. This is necessarily no rapid process, but is an ordered and regulated procedure, sure in its eventual success, but relatively slow also in its establishment and sequential process. This process was initiated upon the astral plane by the Buddha, and on the mental plane when Christ manifested on earth. It indicated the approaching maturity of humanity. The process has been slowly gathering momentum as these two great beings have gathered around them their disciples and initiates during the past 2,000 years. It has reached a point of intensive usefulness as the channel of communication between Shambhala and the hierarchy has been opened and enlarged, and as the contact between these two great centers and humanity has been more firmly established. At the June full moon, 1942, the first test as to the directness of the communication between the center where the will of God holds sway, the center where the love of God rules, and the center where there is intelligent expectancy, was made. The medium of the test was the united effort of the Christ, of the Buddha, and of those who responded to their blended influence. This test had to be carried out in the midst of the terrific onslaught of the powers of evil, and was extended over the 2 weeks beginning on the day of the full moon, May the 30th, 1942, and ending on June 15th, 1942. There was a great concentration of the spiritual forces at that time, and the use of a special invocation, one which humanity itself may not use. But the success or failure of the test was, in the last analysis, determined by mankind itself. You may feel, though wrongly, that not enough people know about or understand the nature of the opportunity or what is transpiring. But the success of such a test is not dependent upon the esoteric knowledge of the few, the relatively few, to whom the facts and the information have been partially imparted. It is dependent also upon the tendency of the many who unconsciously aspire towards the spiritual realities, who seek for a new and better way of life for all, who desire the good of the whole, and whose longing and desire is for a true experience of goodness, of right human relations, and of spiritual enterprise among men. Their name is Legion, and they are to be found in every nation. When the will of God, expressed in Shambhala, and focused in the Buddha, the love of God, expressed in the hierarchy, and focused through the Christ, and the intelligent desire of humanity, focused through the world disciples, the world aspirants, and the men of goodwill, are all brought into line, either consciously or unconsciously, then a great reorientation can and will take place. This event is something that can happen. The first result will be the illumination of the astral plane, and the beginning of the process which will dissipate glamour. The second result will be the irradiation of the mental plane and the dispelling of all past illusions and the gradual revelation of the new truths of which all past ideals and so-called formulations of truth have only been the signposts. Ponder on that statement. The signpost indicates the way to go. It does not reveal the goal. It is indicative but not conclusive. So with all truth up to the present time. The demand is, therefore, for knowers and for those whose minds and hearts are open, who are free from preconceived ideas fanatically held, and from ancient idealisms which must be recognized as only partial indications of great unrealized truths, truths which can be realized in great measure, and for the first time, if the lessons of the present world situation and the catastrophe of the war are duly learned, and the sacrificial will is called into play. I have made this practical application and the immediate illustration of the teaching anent glamour, illusion, and maya because the whole world problem has reached a crisis today, and because its clarification will be the outstanding theme of all progress, educational, religious, and economic, until 2025 A.D. In the section with which we are now concerned, we shall consider the practical ways in which illusion, glamour, and the power of maya can be brought to an end in the life of the individual, and eventually in the life of nations, and finally in the world. Always we must begin with the unity of life, the microcosm. Then, having grasped process and progress in connection with the individual, the idea can then be extended to the group, the organization, the nation, and to humanity as a whole. Thus, gradually, we shall approach the great idea to which we give the name of God, the macrocosm. We shall, in this section, deal with techniques, and these might be summarized as follows. 1. The technique of the presence. By means of this technique, the soul assumes control of the integrated personality and of its relations, horizontal and vertical. This technique involves the unfolding of the flower of the intuition, dispelling illusion, revealing the angel, indicating the presence, and opening up to the disciple the world of ideas and the door of the higher initiations. Through the disciple's grasp and application of these divine ideas or seed thoughts, he becomes initiate, and the third initiation becomes possible as an immediate goal. The intuition is the applied power of transfiguration. This technique is related to the little-known yoga called Agni Yoga, or the Yoga of Fire. 2. The technique of light. By means of this technique, the illumined mind assumes control over the astral or emotional body and dissipates glamour. When light pours in, glamour fades out. Illumination dominates, and the vision of reality can be seen. This technique is related to Raja Yoga, and its goal is the second initiation. It produces ability to tread the path of discipleship and enables the man to live a life enlightened by divinity. Illumination is the applied power of transformation. 3. The technique of indifference. By means of this technique, Maya is ended. For the control of the purified astral vehicle is consciously and technically brought into activity, producing the freeing of the energies of the etheric body from the control of matter or force substance, and bringing men in large numbers onto the vibrationary path. Where there is divine indifference to the call or pull of matter, then inspiration becomes possible. This technique is related to karma yoga in its most practical form, and the use of matter with complete impersonality. The goal of this technique is the first initiation, which enables man to live a life inspired by God. Inspiration is the applied power of transmission. 1. The technique of the presence. As we enter upon our consideration of this subject, the student has three things to bear in mind: the existence of the intuition, the fact of illusion, and the overshadowing presence. This presence is revealed by the intuition through the medium of the angel, and, when revealed and recognized, brings illusion to an end. The story of illusion is one which must not be confounded with glamour. Illusion is related to the whole process of revelation. Glamour can be, and often is, related to the distortion of that which has been revealed, but it must be borne in mind that illusion is primarily concerned with the reaction of the mind to the unfolding revelation, as the soul registers it and seeks to impress it on the highest aspect of the personal lower self. Illusion is, therefore, the failure of the mind correctly to register, to interpret or translate that which has been transmitted, and it is consequently a sin, if you care for that word, of the intelligent and highly developed people, of those who stand on the path and who are in process of becoming rightly oriented. It is also a sin of accepted disciples as they seek to expand their consciousness in response to soul contact. When they have seen through illusion, and I use this phrase in its esoteric sense, then they are ready for the third initiation. Our theme is, therefore, the theme of revelation, and I would like to make some general remarks upon the subject, because thereby the problem of world illusion can be clarified, and incidentally, individual illusion also. The unfoldment of human awareness has been progressive down the ages and has been dependent upon two major and related factors. 1. The factor of the gradual development of the human mind through the processes of evolution itself. This might be regarded as the innate capacity of that which we call the mind, the citta or mind stuff, to become more and more sensitive to the impact of the phenomenal world and the impression from the higher worlds of being. The mind is the instrument which registers the process of becoming, but it is also, during the later stages of human unfoldment, capable of registering the nature or function of being. Becoming is revealed through the medium of the intellect, being through the medium of the intuition. In all study of illusion, the instrumental nature of the mind must be remembered, and its power to register accurately, to interpret and transmit knowledge coming from the world of phenomena and wisdom from the realm of the soul. 2. The factor of the method whereby humanity is made aware of that which is not immediately apparent. This is the method or process of what has been called imposed revelation, or the impression conveyed to minds capable of reception of those ideas, beings, plans, and purposes which exist behind the scenes, so to speak, and which are, in the last analysis, the factors which determine and condition the world process. These revelations, or subjective vital impressions, are revealed by the intuition and have nothing to do with the knowledges, impressions, and impacts which are related to the three worlds of human evolution, except insofar that when grasped and apprehended, they have steadily transformed man's way of living, revealed to him his goals, and indicated his true nature. The revelations given throughout the ages and impressed on the minds of those trained to receive them deal with the great universals, are concerned with the whole, and lead to a developed appreciation of the oneness of life and with hylozoistic expression. Two paralleling processes have produced humanity and its civilization. One is the evolutionary process itself, whereby the mind of the individual has been gradually unfolded until it becomes the dominant aspect in the personality, and at the same time a graded, wisely imparted series of revelations which have led humanity as a whole nearer to the inevitable apprehension of being. They have led him steadily away from identification with form and into those states of consciousness which are supernormal from the ordinary human angle, but entirely normal from the spiritual. Putting this concept specifically into occult terminology, individuality has led to the steady perfecting of the mind with its perception, apprehension, analysis, and interpretation, whilst initiation, through the growth of the intuition, brings about, when the mental perfecting process has reached a relatively high degree of development, the apprehension of the world of spiritual values, of unified being, and of intuitive understanding. This involves a consequent moving of the point of individual focus out of the world of phenomena into the world of reality. The lower use of the mind and its processes of unfoldment have produced illusion, whilst the unfoldment of the higher mind and later its use as the transmitter of the intuition and of the higher revelation will produce the transfiguration of the three worlds of phenomena in terms of the world of being. Illusion is frequently misinterpreted and misapplied mental perception of truth. It has naught to do with the mental phase of glamour, though illusion can be carried down into the world of feeling and become glamour. When this happens, its potency is exceedingly great, because a thought form has become an entity with vital power, and the magnetic power of feeling is added to the cold form of thought. Ponder on this. But at the stage with which we are now dealing, which is that of pure illusion, a revelation has precipitated upon the mental plane, and owing to failure rightly to apprehend and interpret it, or to apply it usefully, it has developed into an illusion and enters upon a career of deception, of crystallization, and of misinformation. The theme of this technique is therefore concerned primarily with 1. The process of revelation. This process has been and today is the main testimony and guarantee of the existence behind the scenes of the phenomenal life of a revealing group or agency whose task is of a triple nature. A. To gauge the unfoldment of the human consciousness and to meet its constant appeal and demand for further light and knowledge. B. To judge what is the next needed revelation and what form it should take, through what medium it should emerge, and where and when it should appear. C. To ascertain with what obstructions, hindrances, and preconceived ideas the new incoming revelation will have to contend. 2. The fact of the presence. This presence is the impelling force behind all revelation and is in reality God immanent, striving ever for recognition and itself impelled thereto by the fact of God transcendent. 3. The influence of the angel, who is the individualized seed of consciousness through whom, after due growth and response of the personal lower self, will come the revelation of the presence. All true revelation is concerned with the unfolding glory of divinity in some field of expression, thereby testifying to the latent, hidden presence. 4. The reaction of the intuitives throughout the world to that revelation and the form in which they present it to the world thinkers. These latter are ever the first to appreciate and appropriate the new truth. The intuitives present the next phase of truth in a relatively pure form, even though at the time of presentation it may be symbolically veiled. 5. The response of the thinking world to the presented truth. It is at this point that illusion appears and misinterpretation and misrepresentation take place. These untrue interpretations of revealed truth, when they have lasted long enough and have acquired momentum, add to the general illusion and become part of it, and thus feed and are fed by the world illusion. This is the built-up illusory form of thought, developed down the ages, which controls so much of the mass belief. When the revelation reaches this stage, the mass of men become involved. They recognize the illusion as the truth. They regard this illusion as reality. They fail to grasp the significance of the veiled, symbolically presented revelation, but confuse it with the illusory presentation, and thus the intuitively perceived revelation becomes a distorted, twisted doctrine. Theological interpretations and dogmas fall into this category, and there ensues a reenactment of the ancient drama of the blind leading the blind, to which Christ referred as he faced the theologians of his time. The above statements are true of all revelation as it comes forth from the emanating center of light, whether they concern so-called religious truth or scientific discoveries or the great standard of spiritual values whereby advanced humanity of both hemispheres seek to live and which, from time to time, move on a step in significance and in importance. A. Intuition dispels individual illusion. Today we have reached a crisis in the field of human apprehension and can now enter into a new era wherein illusion can be dispelled and thinkers can begin to register accurately and without misapprehension that which the intuitives convey to them. This statement does not as yet apply to the general public. It will be a long time before they will respond without illusion, because illusion is based upon the thought form building activity of the lower mind. The masses are just beginning to use that lower mind, and illusion is, therefore, for them a necessary stage of testing and training, and one through which they must pass, or they will lose much valuable experience, leaving undeveloped their powers of discrimination. This is a point which all teachers of occultism should have in mind. It is essential, consequently, that the masses are taught the significance of illusion and be trained to see and choose the kernel of pure truth in any presentation of truth with which they may be confronted. It is essential, likewise, that the world intuitives learn to use and control and understand the faculty of spiritual perception, of divine isolation and appropriate response, which characterizes the intuition. This they can do through the practice of the technique of the presence, but not as it is usually taught and presented. Perhaps I shall make my meaning clearer if I state that this technique falls into certain scientific lines or modes of work for which much of the training given in schools of true meditation and in the Raja Yoga systems have prepared the aspirant. These stages begin where the usual formulas leave off and presuppose facility in approach to the angel or the soul and an ability to raise the consciousness to a point of soul fusion. I will list the processes or stages as follows. 1. The evocation of the stage of tension. This is basic and essential. It is a tension brought about by complete control of the personal self so that it is fitted for contact with the real. 2. The achieving of a state of fusion with the soul or with the angel, which guards the approach to the path of the higher evolution. 3. The holding of the mind steady in the light of the soul, which remains the attitude of the lower self for the entire remaining period of work, held at the point of tension by the soul and not by an effort of the personality. The soul undertakes this holding when the personal self has done its utmost to achieve the desired tension. These are the three preliminary steps for which the practice of alignment should have prepared the student of the higher mysteries. These steps must precede all effort to develop the intuition, and this may take several months or even years of careful preparation. Fire is the symbol of the mind, and these are the first three stages of the Agni Yoga discipline, or of the Yoga of Fire, for which the Raja Yoga has prepared the student. Next come six more stages in the technique, and these must be thoroughly understood and form the basis of prolonged brooding and intelligent reflection, carried on whilst the daily avocations and duties are being performed and not carried out at certain set times. The trained intuitive or disciple lives ever the dual life of mundane activity and of intense and simultaneous spiritual reflection. This will be the outstanding characteristic of the Western disciple, in contradistinction to the Eastern disciple who escapes from life into the silent places and away from the pressures of daily living and constant contact with others. The task of the Western disciple is much harder, but that which he will prove to himself and to the world as a whole will be still higher. This is to be expected if the evolutionary process means anything. The Western races must move forward into spiritual supremacy without obliterating the Eastern contribution, and the functioning of the law of rebirth holds the clue to this and demonstrates this necessity. The tide of life moves from east to west as moves the sun, and those who in past centuries struck the note of Eastern mysticism must strike, and are now striking, the note of Western occultism. Therefore, the following stages must follow upon the three earlier. We will continue with the numbering as given, for what I here suggest is a formula for a more advanced meditation attitude. I said not form. 4. Definite and sustained effort to sense the presence throughout the universe in all forms and in all presentations of truth. This could be expressed in the words, the effort to isolate the germ or seed of divinity which has brought all forms into being. I would point out that this is not the attainment of a loving attitude and a sentimental approach to all people and circumstances. That is the mystical way, and though not intended to be negated in the disciple's life, is not used at this time in the process of effective approach. It is the effort primarily to see in the light which the angel radiates, the point of light, behind all phenomenal appearances. This is, therefore, the transference of the mystical vision to the higher levels of awareness. It is not the vision of the soul, but the vision or the spiritual sensing of that which the light of the soul can aid in revealing. The flickering soul light in the personal self has enabled the disciple to see the vision of the soul, and in that light to reach union with the soul, even if only temporarily. Now the greater light of the soul becomes focused like a radiant sun, and it reveals in its turn a still more stupendous vision, that of the presence, of which the angel is the guarantee and promise. As the light of the moon is the guarantee that the light of the sun exists, so the light of the sun is the guarantee, did you but know it, of a still greater light. 5. Then, having sensed the presence, not theoretically, but in vibrating response to its existence, there next comes the stage of the ascertaining of the purpose. Hope of identification with the purpose lies too far ahead, even for the average initiate, under the status of master. With that unattainable stage for us, we are not concerned, but we are concerned with the effort to achieve an understanding of that which, through the medium of form, is seeking to embody the high purpose of any particular point in the evolutionary cycle. This is possible and has been achieved down the ages by those who have rightly approached and duly reflected upon the way of the higher evolution. This way is revealed to the disciple, even though it may not concern the intuitive message which he may bring back from his high adventure. 6. He then carries some world problem, some design which his mind has evolved or his heart desired, for the helping of humanity into what is esoterically called the triple light of the intuition. This light is formed by the blending of the light of the personal self, focused in the mind, the light of the soul, focused in the angel, and the universal light which the presence emits. This, when done with facility through concentration and long practice, will produce two results. A. There will suddenly dawn upon the disciple's waiting mind, which still remains the agent of reception, the answer to his problem, the clue to what is needed to bring relief to humanity, the information desired, which, when applied, will unlock some door in the realm of science, psychology, or religion. This door, when opened, will bring relief or release to many. As before I have told you, the intuition is never concerned with individual problems or inquiries, as so many self-centered aspirants think. It is purely impersonal and only applicable to humanity in a synthetic sense. B. The intruding agent of light, as the old commentary calls these adventuring intuitives, is recognized as one to whom can be entrusted some revelation, some new impartation of truth, some significant expansion from a seed of truth already given to the race. He then sees a vision, hears a voice, registers a message, or, highest form of all, he becomes a channel of power and light to the world, a conscious embodiment of divinity, or a custodian of a divine principle. These forms constitute true revelation, imparted or embodied. They are still rare, but will increasingly be developed in humanity. 7. The next few stages are called, in preparation for the revelation, A. The relinquishing of the higher way. B. The return to the angel, or a refocusing in the soul. C. A pause or interlude for constructive thinking under the influence of the angel. D. The turning of the mind to the formulation of those forms of thought which must embody the revelation. E. Then again a pause, which is called the pause preceding presentation.
End of side 2, cassette number 4, Glamour, a World Problem, page 182. Continued on cassette number 5.